Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. Welcome to the Elie Spiel Show. It's Thursday night, and tonight we're going to be discussing work by Manly P. Hall. We'll be reading another one of his lectures, An Esoteric Explanation of Drug Abuse and Its Consequences, by Manly P. Hall. That's a kind of interesting essay. I don't know why I thought of reading it, but I think you'll enjoy it. It has a it's fascinating. It's a fascinating subject to me. Why everything that this man did, all of the works that he did were really, really fascinating. You know, just remarkable and insightful works. Manly P. Hall. And again, this is Lecture 167, and it's An Esoteric Explanation of Drug Abuse and Its Consequences. And to start off tonight, it says, although the problem of narcotic addiction has become one of the most pressing issues of our time, very little actually is known about the direct effect of these drugs upon the continuous, or the consciousness, rather, of the human being. We have accumulated a considerable body of observations. We have not yet been able to explain the internal phenomenon itself. We assume for the most part that there is a derangement of the nervous system and that hallucination occurs as a result of the destruction of a natural relationship between the various levels of consciousness and sensory functions. Let us for a moment glance back to see how humanity has looked at this problem over a period of thousands of years. Long before the rise of modern science, man was troubled by the relationship of the objective world in which he lived to another world, one which the Irish call quite simply other world. And man felt that he was in some way divided from a condition of himself which might be described as a universe that probably was qualitative rather than quantitative. Our ancient ancestors assumed quite naturally, in the light of their own experiences, that this other world was a place. Today, we are not quite that empathetic. We're not quite that emphatic. Yet it is possible that we should give thousands of years of folklore more attention and consideration than we have. The ancients believed that there is another dimension to existence, one which is obscured to us not by an arbitrary boundary set up in the universe, but by the limitations of our sensory perceptions. It is conceivable that even in the physical world there is much more than we can see, and that there are many regions of existence for which we have no perceptive capabilities. The phenomenon of radio provides a simple example. Although we can perceive nothing between a broadcasting station and a receiving set, we realize that something is there, and a transmission factor which carries the message from one to the other. Certainly, space around us is full of transmissions, and as radio stations and television studies are multiplied, a tremendous mass of energy movements must result. By using many different wavelengths for the transmission, we keep them separated. Although the magnetic field of the Earth provides the channels, this entire area is completely invisible to us, and without mechanical assistance, it is inaudible as well. There have been some curious experiences having to do with transmission that makes it a fascinating field. A few people, for example, have been able to tune radio stations in on their own bodies. It is quite possible that such transmissions could be received directly by any individual if he were to train the necessary faculties within himself. And many believe that if a box can be manufactured with certain electrical components, there is no reason why man, an infinitely more wonderful device, could not do as well himself directly. Just as we are now aware that there is an unperceived world of sound around us, we are also cognizant that there is a world of color into which we are unable to tune ourselves. We know that there are things we do not see or hear. The next question is, what kind of region is this that lies outside the range of our sensory perception? Conceivably, it could be an actual place. The salt, the believed thusly, and most other ancient peoples as well. Certainly it was a common belief among North American and Indian tribes. Somewhere there existed a mysterious gateway through which usually man passed only at death, although it was possible that he could do so while still living. If he could not pass through alive, certainly he could stand and look through a window into the other world, as our Irish ancestors called it. The nature of the outer world long has been a matter for speculation, but in a number of systems of ancient religion and philosophy, opinions were developed which perhaps are worthy of a second thought. First of all, what really is this other region? Oriental religions, especially Hinduism, have taught that we should not consider it simply as another region, but as a vast world of regions. There are many levels of vibration and of consciousness outside our own, which, although not normally available to us, nevertheless do exist, and in which all kinds of life and conditions are to be found. Recent research by the University of California and the California Institute of Technology indicate that there could be other orders of life coexisting with us, which we cannot see and do not as yet know. Not spirits of the dead or anything of that nature, but various other orders of life which are evolving in their own way, and which vibratory levels preclude from contact with us. The ancient thoughts that one of the regions outside the compass of the material world was that they called the world of the astral light. They called the world of the astral light. This idea has been well developed in many mythological systems. In Wagner's opera Parsifal, this world of the astral light is well symbolized as Klingsor's enchanted garden, and such enchantment abounds in mythology. And they all seem to stem from the belief that there is another world around us in which many different types of life could exist, beings that do not manifest on our own plane at all. Some that burst through occasionally in extraordinary examples of psychic phenomena, and still others that perhaps are included in the pattern of the so-called dead. Regardless of what or who these otherworldly beings are, we can believe that we are surrounded by a universe of active vital forces. The Hindus declared that directly beyond the experience of our world lies a region of twofold emotional nature, to which they have given the name Kamaloka and Devashan. And Kamaloka corresponds closely to our idea of purgatory, except that it is not deity that dooms one to suffer there. It is a mysterious way we are associated with our own conduct. And Kamaloka is, to the Oriental, a realm in which the individual's own attitudes create the condition in which he exists. It is amazing how much we actually can influence matter in the creation of private worlds. Very few people live in the physical world exactly as it is. Most live in it according to their own interpretation. This interpretation may be so very vital and vivid that it leads to all kinds of complicated psychological consequences. We do shape our world by our attitudes, and the ancients believed that man also shaped his afterlife by his attitudes. Kamaloka is the name they gave to the area in which his emotional intensities took on symbolic form. Here the individual, as in a dream, receives situations which result from his own intensities, and because the body is no longer an insulating factor, experiences are much more impressive. Both the Greeks and the Egyptians held to this idea, and although we have drifted far away from it, it is fair to point out that we have done so without ever acknowledging, actually disapproving it. We have rejected it largely because it does not fit in with our new materialistic way of life. If there is any truth in the old belief in the realm of the astral light, then medieval magicians such as Agrippa and Paracelsus may have been correct when they assumed that it is a world in which each individual manufactures for himself a kind of existence out of a subtle substance that is very much like the stuff of which dreams are made. And in this substance, his own will, his imagination, and his attitudes create for him living forms and patterns peculiar to himself alone. That's fascinating. We all do this. And we all do this, create our own realities. And the realm of the astral light would be the natural abode of the fanciful. Fancy always has posed a problem to human understanding. It has been recognized in poetry, literature, and art, but having little solid substance, it has been less than solidly understood. Although it seems to be more than a mere passing product of the imagination. The substance of the astral light, therefore, whatever it may be, there is a kind of world in which all things are as expected, whereby, as pointed out by the old transcendentalists, expectation itself becomes a danger. And the individual who lives in a world in which all things fulfill his own attitude toward them may find himself in an absolutely hopeless situation. If he creates unjustifiable solutions to problems, which result largely from his own selfishness, he very well may be captured in the consequences of his own attitudes. If man has the capacity to cause his expectations to take on an illusionary appearance, either in death or vision or trance or dream, he will experience outside of himself only what he himself expects, only that which his own ego makes possible to him. This is, of course, a point in Buddhist philosophy. Buddhism says very frankly that this is what we do with physical situations. We force them into our own expectancy. We decide how things are going to be, blocking out one idea because we don't believe it, and magnifying another because we do. Gradually, we build attitudes toward living, and even a way of life having little, if any, essential substance. The Buddhist answer to this is gradually to overcome the tendencies to fantastic expectancy, and the individual must begin to search for realities that are not associated with his own demands upon life. He must learn to discover the real universe by ceasing to manufacture an artificial one and trying to live in it. This is true both in personal and family relations. We have codes of expectancy and measure all things by these codes. But in the code itself, is the code itself valid? If we look at the larger pattern the same way, then we very well may find that the ancients were right, that we are surrounded by a mysterious realm of dreaming, which for most persons is a nightmare, because they do not dream honestly. In fact, most dreams are pressures, and in the larger pattern of the universe, such pressures could be very great and very real. Ancient peoples also were of the opinion that due to the action of the karma, some consideration has to be given to persons who leave this world under unusual, dramatic, or terrible circumstances. We assume that when we execute a criminal, we have disposed of him. But have we? Or have we really done that which has been a common policy? Have we tried to induce him to leave the state and settle somewhere else? There are times when we really have felt that we have solved the problem of crime by pushing it out of California and settling it in Nevada. Have we any greater reason to assume that we have solved the problem of the criminal by forcing such an entity out of life entirely? Is he actually gone? Has he become nothing? Or has he become part of another world, which to a measure at least can impinge upon this one? It was the belief of ancient peoples that the dead lived, and that to a measure, the corruptions which they have taken with them into the afterlife can indirectly affect the living. Various people with various attitudes leaving life can experience a condition which medieval philosophers called earthbound, wherein they do not pass forward immediately in the great cycle of life, or remain in a state of antagonism toward the world they have left behind. This antagonism can be of several kinds. There may be antagonism against people who have contrived to the dead person's miseries during his life on earth. Another cause of the Aleth-Brown state may be an individual's inability to renounce the material world even after he is no longer of it. His attachment to possessions and persons, his addictions and ambitions, any of these might survive the death of the individual. And if they do, they can be associated with the material conditions in certain ways. Ancient peoples also spoke of elements, elementals, and elementaries, which have a relationship to life, but which we are incapable of seeing. Of these, probably the more important to our way of thinking would be the elementaries. According to the Paracelsian theory, derived from the ancient mystics of the Near East and North Africa, these elementaries are thought are emotions or emotion forms. They are the sum of attitudes upon the living. It is assumed that both thought and emotion are rates of vibration, and that when many individuals agree in attitude, the attitude is so supported and strengthened that it becomes factual in the vibratory atmosphere of our world. That's what happened in the case of Obama and how he became elected. And the explanation most often given for the consequence of war and various mass intolerances of people, such as the Spanish Inquisition, is that they are the result of the building up of emotion forms which may have the effect of corrupting the lives of persons in this world. And that's what's happened in this world. That's what's happened in this country. And if it is true that the energy field of the earth is the source of all energy for man, and it can be distorted or in any way polluted by man, then pollution becomes involved in the energy resources of every living person. We are beginning to understand that it means to pollute what it means to pollute the world physically. It is possible that the world can be polluted psychically as well, and that energies which arise in destructiveness for a period of centuries can condition the life of man. That's true. Recent experiments as to the effect of prayer on the growth of plants parallels that we have been discussing here. This work has been well enough authenticated to appear in a number of learned journals. Plants upon which much personal constructive emotion has been bestowed have very definitely responded by growing better and have been more perfect plants. Many years ago, I talked with Luther Burbank about this very subject. He said that the effect of human attitude upon plants is obvious and that we could prove it in many ways. He was quite certain that the plant life understood his thoughts and that it responded according to the nature of these thoughts. And the university sent a number of students to study with Mr. Burbank, and he very carefully explained these theories to them. However, the students regarded it as superstition, and ignoring his advice, they carefully and scientifically did exactly what he did physically with his plants and got no results, or at best very poor results. He told me that the only person who ever really understood and could sit down and have a heart-to-heart meditative communion with plants was his Chinese gardener. And he was the only person who obtained results as good as Burbank's. Assuming then that attitudes can be transmitted in this way, and enlarging the scope of the transmissions, we may come to the realization that mental attitudes and emotional intensities do construct and destroy. Their area of construction or destruction is outside the personal life of the individual, extending beyond him into other regions of life. We know that hatred goes beyond the person and affects the family and perhaps the community and ultimately the world. We realized also that today pollution is our greatest problem. What if we have been building up in the magnetic field of a world a reservoir of pollution? Have changed the energy field as we, for example, apparently are changing the ocean from a source of life to a source of death. If the vibratory patterns which we send out are contrary to the vibratory patterns which sustain life, it is possible that we are bringing about serious change. Reparation will not be meted out by a group of avenging angels. It will be instrumented through human beings whose energy supply has been corrupt from their birth. These human beings will not have the pure attitudes they would have had, had not the source of their life principle been contaminated by an endless flood of human selfishness. The medieval magician said very simply that selfishness is an organism as dangerous as a cancer. Selfishness is an attitude building up over thousands of years, expresses itself not only by the corruption of the life stream in the physical life of the individual, but by destroying the purity of the energies which support him in nature. This seems to be a far-out point of view, but our present familiar points of view are not brought about any positive effects. We have not yet developed ethics strong enough to induce self-centered persons to change their ways. Our entertainment world is corrupt, social life is corrupt, and the individuals involved have absolutely no intention of changing their ways. As long as their present course of procedure is even remotely profitable. Let us assume for a moment that this widespread decadence stems from the fact that man's source of nutrition is nature. His psychological source of nerve nutrition, the source of the substance from which his thoughts and emotions are generated, is contaminated. And unless some way be found to clean the Aegean stable, it will become worse. For one thing, man has no realization of how closely related the problem of psychological pollution is to that of physical pollution. And physical pollution is a mass of small deposits of refuse swept into oceans, rivers, and lakes. It is the corruption of air through the continuous addition of fumes and chemicals to our atmosphere. Now, no one can say that the invisible contaminants in our air are not affecting health, nor can we be at all certain that in affecting health, they do not also affect character. If we are sufficiently endangered by these contaminants, our resistance to negative attitudes will be reduced, and we will become more and more like the critical and condemning people who already are too numerous in our present generation. The only protection we have, and it may not be complete, lies within our own character. If he is internally disturbed, perhaps by these potent emotional and mental factors, the individual recognizes the disturbance for what it is and realizes that his attitudes are disintegrating, and he has the right to impose greater energy upon himself in a heroic attempt to maintain his standards despite the difficulties of the times. We have to do this every day in our physical lives. Thoughtful persons still struggle against the pressure of the mass. There also well may be persons who, upon whom negative energies operate more easily than upon others. And the better integrated a person is, the better equipped he is to face the temptations and problems of life. So you got to be integrated, folks. Know how to weave and dodge with the good and the bad. And this has always been more or less the point of view of religion. It is spoken in the Bible that though 1,000 fall upon the light on the right hand and 1,000 fall upon the left hand, the just man shall not be moved. And the only protection we have against psychological pollution is our own integrity. There is no doubt that our integrity can be weakened by the pollutant factors, but possibly we can maintain it until gradually we find ways of avoiding the distribution of pollutants themselves. And down through time, man has passed through crises such as ours, and then has risen to some strong statement of conviction, turning the mind and emotions into more constructive attitudes, whereupon the situation has temporarily abated. What has all this to do with the problem of narcotics? It is a point of view we have tried to establish as a background. Now let us imagine that somewhere outside our own community, which is at present comparatively free of psychic toxins, there are in the magnetic field of the earth polluted regions, such as we have been describing. Between us and these pollutants, nature has set up barriers to protect us. As Dr. Kilner observed in a study of the human atmospheres, through means of the Kilner screen of Liverpool at Liverpool Hospital, every individual is protected by a magnetic field. This magnetic field, which is seated mainly in the abdominal area of the body, is continually struggling to maintain the necessary energy level. If for any reason the energy level is lowered beyond a certain point, functions and organs can no longer be maintained properly, and physical ailments begin to appear in the weaker areas of the body. Dr. Kilner pointed out that a magnetic field around the human body is sufficiently strong to keep a person who is in good health comparatively free of infection and contagion. We all have observed that some people appear to have this nature defense mechanism, whereas others do not. A simple example of this process in nature may be drawn from certain experimentations with roses. The aphis is a plague to this particular flower, and every type of insecticide and spray has been used to protect the rose from aphids. Recently, an investigation has indicated that the best way to save the plant from destruction by its little enemy is to make sure that the plant itself has proper nutrition. If the plant is healthy, the aphis will not take over. If the energy field of the plant is depleted, it may be that no insecticide can save it. There seems to be a parallel problem in man involving nutrition. If we maintain the nutritional levels which sustain the person in maximum efficiency, he is resistant to any ailments which otherwise could destroy him. In the magnetic field, according to Dr. Kilner, the magnetic emanations from the body form a defensive wall to which psychophysical organisms cannot penetrate. Even the smallest living bacteria or microorganism has its own magnetic field, and the magnetic field of certain destructive factors differs from that of constructive ones, as the effect in the body shows. Dr. Kilner pointed out that our first line of defense against physical problems is the maintenance of a high level of body energy. Old Greek and Hindu thinking extends this belief to include the mental and emotional realms of our lives. It is most important to maintain the levels of the magnetic field, as this is our primary protection against psychic pollution. Our defense against the pressure moving in upon us from a polluted energy reservoir lies in maintaining as high a level of personal integrity as possible. Yoga points out that this level of vital intensity is most important, not only physically, but mentally and emotionally. And any part of our system which is not adequately sustained nutritionally will develop symptoms of trouble, mentally and emotionally as well as physically. When energy is necessary for our mental and emotional normalcy are not available, we begin to break down physically, just as surely as the mental and emotional natures suffer when physical nutrition fails. The protective magnetic field shown by Dr. Kilner also indicates that its structure, the continual moods of human beings, in its structure rather, our magnetic fields or aura, our magnetic field or aura is profoundly influenced by our attitudes, and there is not a doubt that we can make ourselves sick by polluting our own magnetic field, for it is the source of the energy necessary to maintain the body. If we load it with attitudes of futility, if we suffer from various physical defects as a result, our attitudes react upon our body. And we have long observed this phenomenon, but there has been very little effort to explain it scientifically. If the individual, for one reason or another, lowers his various levels of resistances, his body is affected by a city his body is affected as a city is betrayed by a traitor within who opens the gates to the enemy. And anything by means of which we lower our defense against negation opens us to some form of trouble. Devitalization, debilitation, malnutrition all opens us to certain physical difficulties. Emotional or mental negation also opens us to trouble by weakening the magnetic field. Now, if the energy in the Earth's magnetic field were unconditioned, we might at worst cause ourselves to suffer from a sort of psychological anemia. But if something unpleasant is dwelling there and we open ourselves to it, then we may find ourselves in a much greater situation. Our forebears attempted to explain the importance of maintaining an integration of individuality that is strong, upright, clear, and courageous enough to maintain throughout our lifetime a completely positive magnetic field which is essentially healthy. And those studying the effect of the emotion on the aura of the human body have observed that every move, every thought, causes a change in the coloration and the structure of this field. And a long period of bitterness, for example, will debilitate our energy reserves and block off the flow of constructive energies, energizing remedial factors. And the body is built not of physical bricks, but of energy transmitted to structure. Almost everyone who has seriously studied this effect has pointed out the tremendous importance of a life of integrity, not merely for the sake of clear conscience, but because when we break the rules of maintaining a constructive relationship in our consciousness, we are opening ourselves to a series of physical and psychological disasters. We must not permit internal warfare to divide our resources and contaminate them, nor should we permit any preventable mistake of character to drain off energy for a useless and destructive end. It becomes extremely important for the individual to keep up his own defenses, because they are the only protection he has from a strange world of uncertainty. In the terms of the medieval transcendentalists, the astral light of delusion, and in terms of our modern thinking, all kinds of pollution, anything that causes disharmony and destroys the proper defenses against negation, definitely can bring disaster upon a person. And this, it seems to me, is one approach to the problem of narcotics. Research and experimentation in the psychic field indicate that the use of narcotics does two things. It short-circuits the magnetic field, and as a result of destroying its defenses, it opens the individual to whatever lies beyond the magnetic field. We have noticed that whenever the individual has lost control of his psychic life, his threshold is lowered. He is not a better person. He becomes more and more inclined to compromise values. Also, most individuals who have come under a heavy psychological depletion lose, for the most part, their essential humanity. They become maladjusted, unrealistic, and even very often criminal because they have lost control from within themselves at the level upon which they will function. Man is supposed to function on the highest possible level of the coordination of his faculties and resources. He is supposed to live on the top of his own pyramid of values. And as the Greek philosopher said, that man is best in whom the best part rules the rest. Now the best part of the individual is his character, and his character is maintained physically by the condition of his body and his nutritional and magnetic fields, by his emotional adjustment to the emotional energies of the world around him, and by his mental adjustment to the mental experience of the universe. Mental and emotional adjustments are matters of maintaining contact with the highest possible levels of mental and emotional nutrition. As long as the mental and emotional nutrition are derived from the top level of natural available resource, the individual receives the best available nutrition for his own use. If, however, he begins to go downward in his vibratory cycle, he tunes into ever lower levels of energy resource. No longer does he tune into the Devakam, or the heavenly world of the Hindus, but rather Kamaloka, the region of illusions and hallucinations. He tunes in according to his own level of function, and anything that lowers the level of function is going to result in the deterioration of character. It's a little long got plenty of time. If we assume, then, that there is a relationship between the individual and his world, what happens during what is referred to as a bad trip is simply this. The individual has become involved in one of the lower levels of the hallucinational factor in nature, the astral light. He has lowered his resources until he is part of a chaos which has already been there, but with which he should not be involved. It is a part of nature's method of disposing of rubbish. Nature passes the negation refuse of human life through a series of transformations, which he would call recycling. This recycling process finally returns pure energy to the sun, where it is again available for use. In this process of breaking down corruption and cleaning up the emotional sphere of life, a series of situations comes into existence which is bewildering and dangerous to the person who, without knowledge or understanding, becomes involved in it. These levels are loaded, according to the ancients, with the refuse of negative human emotions and terrible pressures of degeneracy arise within them. A person who lowers his magnetic defenses and begins to draw his emotional material from one of these corrupted levels is going to have rather frightening experiences. Although they are illusionary, they are strangely real in their negative implications. What are the factors which have impelled some person to really believe, and I know they do, that drug-induced conditions become the basis of belief in a universe larger than in the one of the materialists? Much of the narcotics involvement stems from the belief that the individual, by means of the experiences through which he passes, becomes more convinced of the integrity of the universe, or at least of an existence beyond himself which gives him the hope of immortality. Effects vary with a person. The difference between a bad trip and a so-called good one is, in the measure at least, psychological. The individual who by his nature tunes into an especially low level is going to be flooded with the contaminants of that level. The person who is naturally unselfish and idealistic may fare a little better, but still he is making a very dangerous move, opening his psychic field to unknown forces and circumstances. There is ample evidence that it is not the kind of experiment which the average person should attempt. It is a sort of poor man's yoga, and the man cannot pay the bill. The man cannot pay the bill, therefore he does not achieve the end for which he hopes. He simply opens himself to a fantasy in which he becomes disoriented, and in this disorientation, he loses contact with the world. We all do that, even with or without drugs, but it's definitely a danger. Unfortunately, the sphere into which he is attempting to escape cannot sustain him, because it is no reality other than that which is given it by its own attitudes. Visual phenomena produced by the use of hallucinogenic drugs cannot be regarded as valid proof of anything, and any more than a nightmare can be cited as valid proof of life after death. It is simply a non-related factor. And let us now consider another possibility and see if we can bridge the two. The effect of drugs is a subconscious psychical phenomenon within the individual. This phenomenon, like all others, depends on its existence upon energy. When there is insufficient magnetic energy, internal experience is distorted, and if the individual has powerful attitudes, this distortion is going to be strong. The individual, for example, who turns hallucinative drugs because of resentment against society is held contemned by his negative attitude for negativisms not produced by a constructive result. It is thus insisting that if we have enough wars, we will have peace. It is just not true. And any attitude which is nourished, especially a negative one, is going to load the subconscious of the individual until it reaches the proportions of Kamaloka or purgatory itself. and the average person's purgatory lies within himself. It is the unfinished business in his own nature, the ill he has done himself in his efforts to do an ill to another. He is completely overburdened, not necessarily because of any one great crime, but because he has continually fed pollutants into his inner life. In arguments at home, trouble with children, cheating in business, rebellion against political situations, resentment of 100 kinds against 100 people, all these feed the subconscious a mass of unreasonable vibratory units which are not assimilable. They do not form consistent constructive patterns. Not are they even compatible among themselves, for two wrongs do not make a right. Thus, the individual is burdened with tremendous pressure, largely the two wrong training and wrong attitude. Having received no constructive instruction in the use of his inner facilities or faculties, he reaches maturity without realizing the importance of integrity. In almost every moment he lives, he is drawn away from integrity by self-interest and irresistible impulses to satisfy appetites and to attain luxuries and pleasures. The way in which he gets them is of secondary consideration. He is loaded, therefore, with a tremendous amount of chaos. And psychology points out that all of these chaotic factors are entities. Attitudes are units of life. They are a kind of psychically generated bacteria, which build up within a person to form destructive, sick tissue, a psychic cancer. Only conscious minds can maintain a high level of function. Consciousness itself acts as a sensor upon the subconscious. As long as the person is determined in his consciousness to live the life as well as he can, perform some constructive actions, his karmic load becomes neutralized. The more constructive emotion he can pour into his subconscious, the more relief he will have from the destructive pressures that live there. And in the course of time, a constructive life well lived can gradually dissolve a negative psychic situation. But no doubt of counseling, no amount of counseling is going to extrovert it completely. As long as the person continues to cause it, it will rebuild. And even though it has been well ventilated, with the result that the person is struggling to maintain a healthy subconscious life by combining as much good as possible with the inevitable weaknesses of his own character. If you introduce narcotics into this situation, you destroy the validity of the sensor. You break down the patterns of self-control and throw the individual open to his own subconscious, which manifests through an infinite variety of symbols. In very many instances, these symbols are at first strongly influenced by the social situations of living, and the individual experiences what he feels to be a delightful state of affairs. The longer he continues, however, the lower the level of these reactions, until finally he discovers himself to be an absolute purgatory. He has gone down far enough into the various strata of his own subconscious to find lurking there all the demonology ever described in any book on witchcraft. It is all in there. It is himself. And now, assuming that this is the condition within the person, we must also recognize that this relationship of strata, the inner life, is maintained by means of energy bridges. The vitality or magnetic field of a person causes him to settle in whatever level with which he has something in common. Therefore, if he can lower his resistance by destroying the protection of his own magnetic field, not only will he be very miserable within himself, but he will leave himself open to the negative mystery of the astral light. This mystery has been described by one transcendentalist as a wondrous world of beautiful flowers with a deadly snake twisted around the stem of each. It is very largely the field of gratification. The more the individual attempts to live in a state of total gratification, the more he corrupts himself and becomes involved in a negative psychic situation. If he continues this course at the end of his life, making no effort to improve himself, then it may be assumed that he is going to drift into the next life as a unit of self-gratification. He will function in a world of negation until, through a series of natural processes, he is brought back into a re-embodiment to clean up the mess he has caused in his first place. Therefore, the person who once lowers his resistance to values, who tries in a negative way to attain a superior state, will be frustrated. He cannot do it. No amount of artificial means can add one unit to the integrity of the person. Furthermore, up to the present time, most of these processes have immediately lowered the level of integrity. They have resulted in serious damage to the connective nerve structures, bad mental attitudes, and threatened mental disease, and in some cases at least have led to suicide. And upon a false assumption, we open a Pandora's box and allow a situation to arise which can be corrected only by rebuilding the barriers which keep negation apart from the normal way of life. I'm just going to stop there for a second, because I always wondered why so many celebrities and actors and actresses and comedians and everybody are so connected. So they're either connected, yeah, addicted to cocaine, alcohol, painkillers, pot. You know, they're all addicted to something, and they have to. But that intensity of that high that allow them to overcome the barriers of your own self-consciousness to create that alter ego, that persona that gets paid $20 million a movie or, whatever. Those personalities are seemingly enhanced by the use of marijuana or certain narcotics, because great painters, great poets, great artists, they've all been under the influence. Great scientists, lots of them have had drug abuse situations. You wonder if Freud or Jung or any of these great men of science or psychology, psychiatry, could have possibly been as astute to the conditions if they themselves weren't addicts. Freud being, I believe, a cocaine addict. We must crawl out of this sea of polluted energy. In so doing, we restore the field itself, where it can be changed only when the magnetic pressure of individuals is changed. We should be a strong cooperation between man and nature, around and within him. Excuse me. We are meant to live responsibly or reasonably in this world, and had we done so, we would not have the problems we have now. The consequences of thoughtlessness and selfishness affect our lives physically, and the consequences of mental and emotional thoughtlessness and indifference to reality are apparent in our metaphysical life. We have allowed our minds to go to the seed and to be used by purposes, unworthy of the equipment with which we have been endowed. I may have enough time to finish this. 3.5 billion human beings functioning largely on a negative level are pouring unthinkable refuse out of the... Imagine, there was only 3.5 billion people on Earth in 1972. 45 years later, there's 7.5 billion. Amazing. Largely on negative levels, are pouring unthinkable refuse out of the magnetic fields of their own bodies into the magnetic reservoir of the planet itself. This magnetism is not a blind, mindless agent, although it does not have a personal attitude. The reaction upon us is affected just as it is when a stream, river, or lake has been so contaminated that it can no longer maintain life. The lake does not fight back. It does not point an accusing finger at anyone particularly. The fact is merely that the people can only blame themselves for the desecration of natural resources. An internal rational plan which justifies the improvement of the person as a natural responsibility becomes popularized. We are not going to get very far in our attempts to right the situation. It is obvious that the average person's sphere of influence is not great enough to make immediate or dynamic changes, but somehow we must cope with it. We have tried law as a means, but what have laws meant to the individual whose crimes have been not illegal, but wrong in the face of nature? What do laws have to do with family disputes and arguments, with selfishness and over-ambition? And nothing unless they reach a point where crime is committed. The crime the individual commits against himself is not easily avoided by major social change, for the more the individual becomes devitalized in terms of the quality of his nature, the less anxious he is to change and improve himself. We would prefer to drift into an oblivion of sorts, by nature will not let him, but nature will not let him. He will instead drift into a condition in which it becomes indispensable to his own survival to do something about it. This is part of the nature of nature's machinery. We now know that if we want a healthy physical world, we must take care of it properly. If we want a physical nutrition, we have to take care of that too. If we are concerned about fertilizers and insecticides endangering our foods, but we should remember that the most important part of our nutrition is that which comes to the body from the magnetic fields of the sun as it passes through the magnetic field of the earth and into the magnetic field of the individual. Without it, nothing can live. And turning off the sun and our story ends. This is the real source of our nutrition, and the channels through which it passes must be kept clean. And the earth must be maintained properly so as to accept solar energy. And we must so order our lives that we are capable of receiving this magnetic energy into our own composite nature. And somewhat otherwise, we cannot function. And anything that interferes with this natural process of life, or which includes the individual, to believe that there is a cheap way out of artificial by artificial means, leads to tragedy. And we can look at this in what's happening today with chemtrails and ground contaminants and water pollution. And, oh my God, it's worse than it ever has been. And back in '72, there were no chemtrails. He would be amazed, he'd be shocked at seeing what it is today. More than ever, let's see. More than ever today, we need the full use of every faculty we possess. We should use our faculties to the best of our ability at all times, dedicating them to the highest and most constructive efforts we know to improve ourselves. In our community's existence. He who fails to do this adds to pollution. The use of drugs has a debilitating effect upon the clarity of human vision and intelligence. He who indulges in it is in danger of making a perilous journey into the region of the astral light from which he may or may not return in this embodiment. Wow. He's exchanging the possibility of living a great and noble philosophy profitless magic, which is really only a form of emotional fantasy. And the drug user is trying to escape life, but he will not escape, although he may reach the point where his dreams are so thick that he no longer can see what is happening to him. Those who have had some contact with narcotics will be wise not to continue with them. They should instead work together to better way of life, earned by conscious endeavor, directed by a clear mind and motivated by clean emotions. We cannot too strongly urge everyone to do everything possible in the course of daily life to maintain an equilibrium of consciousness. to maintain hope, to be strong in a conviction about good, and to take an increasingly kind and compassionate attitude toward those around them. Good attitudes energize man's life because they enrich the magnetic field. The poison in this field is to bring auto-intoxication upon ourselves. The more we poison the field, the worse we feel, the worse we feel, the worse we act, and the worse we act, and more we continue to corrupt the field. Singly and collectively, we cannot afford to continue moral policies which endanger the magnetic field of the Earth. For if we do, we will cycle disaster after disaster upon ourselves. And a great principle, however, that should not be overlooked is that man is constituted so that if he behaves himself, he will be protected. If he does not behave himself, nothing can protect him. We do not have to be the victims of the mistakes of others. Nature does not intend this. Everything is a matter of integrity. If we maintain our own integrity, we can survive with dignity under any situation. But if we pervert our integrity, we cannot escape the consequences, regardless of the apparent prosperity of our way of life. And that's the end of that essay. This was essay number, or lecture 163, copyright 1973. Manly P. Hall, the Philosophical Research Society, Los Angeles, Los Feliz Boulevard, Los Angeles, California. And that's basically, I thought that was an interesting article tonight, showing how where we seem to always be missing the missing link, and the missing link is integrity, which many of us, which all of us, I should say, question that daily, our integrity, if we're doing this right or should do that or shouldn't do that. Are we following our true course? Are we being true to ourselves? To our own visions, and our visions hallucinations, or are they real? My world, I'm hoping that they're one and the same, that they're real, you know. And hopefully we can all keep our heads straight to some degree. Like, I'll leave you with John Lennon's words of whatever gets you through the night is all right, it's all right. Man, that's true. So from that, I thank you very much for joining us. Have a great night, and remember, whatever gets you through the night